History of shamanic use in the Andes of South America. You can be a strict constructionist in the matter of psychedelics, or you can cast your net widely. There are many substances in nature which alter consciousness, either stimulate or sedate or create more ambiguous and spectacular effects. I would describe what the effects of Datura as a deliriant. Now, the shamans who use these things have special techniques both of preparation and of training that allow them to control or navigate around the more unpleasant aspects of Datura. It tends to provoke memory loss, shall we say, bizarre behavior, such as taking your clothes off in public and so on. And it creates a general ambiance of uncertainty about the nature of reality. And what I mean by that is you talk to people who aren't there, you smoke cigarettes that aren't there, you answer phone calls when you're standing in the woods. From the outside, it looks pretty fucked up, you know? But some Aboriginal and Native traditions have managed to tame this, at least in the shamanic context. I guess in this matter I'm a kind of strict constructionist in that when I say psychedelic, I have something very specific in mind that a substance or a plant should do. It should not inhibit clarity. In other words, not episodes of forgetfulness, lack of memory, passing out, or confusion. It shouldn't interfere with that, and it should transform thought. And it should be accompanied by visual hallucinations with eyes closed. That's what I love. That's what I live for. Now, people have said to me, you're some kind of a vision chauvinist. It's true, and usually the people who were saying this were people who were great enthusiasts of LSD. LSD, I would never argue, is not a psychedelic, but you have to take massive amounts, and usually in combination with some other substance like hashish or mescaline, in order to elicit from LSD what I'm after, which is cascades of Niagaras of visual beauty in darkness with eyes closed. I have had deep psychological insights on LSD. I have had creative breakthroughs. I have had bonding experiences, but I found it difficult to get the visions like I wanted them. And the best I worked out with LSD was I would smoke as much Afghani hash as I could at the top of the trip, and then it would do the thing. In fact, it would do it. The thing that led me to psilocybin or to grow mushrooms and explore that was the descriptions of Wasson and the early workers that it was easy to visually hallucinate. And I had read the earlier accounts of Havelock Ellis and people like that, and it was about, you know, if you've ever read in, I think it's The Dance of Life, Havelock Ellis's description of mescaline, he talks about alien buildings, jeweled ruins, fantastically efflorescent rainforest growing and transforming before his eyes. That's what I was after. I wanted not a disturbance in the optic nerve. You know, like on LSD, you get those little things that look sort of like fans that creep across the walls. That's more like something in the visual cortex than something in the mind, it seems to me. And I was fascinated, and who isn't? I mean, I never hear this question discussed, but to me it was the obvious question about these visions was, where do they come from? You know, how can I be astonished by the contents of my own mind? And astonished over and over again, where is this stuff coming from? And I looked at Jung, and I entertained the fantasy of extraterrestrial contact, and I still haven't answered this question. But I think it's a question which the critics of the psychedelic experience haven't wanted to deal with. You know, if you read the psychedelic literature, you can tell what psilocybin does to heartbeat, sperm count, to perception of tone, on and on. They never talk about the real content, you know, because it's always individual. And they say, well, science can't handle individual phenomena. We measure the properties of large numbers of people. Well, that hopelessly flattens the thing. I know this is a long answer to this question, but it's worth laying all this out, because the lady's question raises issues of how do you categorize psychedelics, which aren't, are some dangerous, and to what degree? Certainly Datura is dangerous, not only because of its delirium quality, which makes you irresponsible, but also because it dilates your pupils and you stumble around, and at higher doses it can cause convulsion and death, which is a rare thing from what I consider the true psychedelics. There is, if we want to take an excursion here for a moment and learn a little pharmacology, there is, if you're going to talk about pharmacology, there's one concept that you should get straight, and that's called LD50. It means lethal dose 50. What does this mean? Well, you have 20 rats, and you give them a certain amount of, let's say, mescaline. When half the rats die, that dose, expressed as milligrams per kilogram of body weight, is called the LD50. And when pharmacologists assess the danger in a drug, they ask the following question: what is the ratio of the LD50 to the effective dose? And if the LD50 of a drug is only 20 times the effective dose, that's considered an incredibly toxic, dangerous, and dubious drug. A good drug is a drug where the LD50 is 200 times more than the effective dose. In the case of LSD, the LD50 for man has never been determined. That's how safe LSD is. And we're talking about lethality here, not, you know. But so and so people say, well, are there unsafe psychedelics? And yes, you just look up the LD50s, line them up, and see which have the better ratios. By that measurement, by that standard, LSD is the most desirable. But the LD50 of psilocybin is very impressive. You know, you can take 100 times the effective dose of psilocybin and expect to live. Mescaline, not. Mescaline has a bad profile. As an amphetamine, if you took 20 times the effective dose of mescaline, you would probably die. Of course, an effective dose of mescaline is nearly a gram of pure material, 700 milligrams. If you took 20 times 700 milligrams, you would be taking almost a complete, you know, nearly two-thirds of an ounce of mescaline. And why should you survive? After all, stupidity does have consequences. But really, people always ask the question, are psychedelics dangerous? the, you know, and they mean physically dangerous, what should be said, and it's recently been pointed out to me that I don't say it very often, is that the biggest danger with psychedelics is that while you are in that open state, some moron will mess with you and either lay a suggestion or plant an idea or manipulate you or scare you or turn you in a way that you wouldn't ordinarily go. And this is why psychedelic etiquette means knowing your tripping partners. People who take psychedelics with strangers at high dose do come back with wild tales to tell, but I don't think you can do that over and over again without having some horrible thing befall you. My mind is not, I mean, some people seem more resilient. I am not. You know, people often ask me to trip them. And I won't, and it's not because of concern for the legal system or the fact that I am not licensed for psychotherapy or any of that. It's because I can't stand it when people come apart on psychedelics. I am, you know, if you're interested in this subject or if you share my sensitivity, read Carl Jung's little book called On the Psychology of the Transference. And then you will understand. In fact, that should be a standard tome for trippers. Understand the transference. Understand what it is, how to fight it, and this is psychic martial arts. Good, your psychic health will be immeasurably improved by understanding the dynamics of the transference, which is quite simple. The book is not that thick. Now to answer the lady's question. When I took Datura, I had reality distorting strange. And if I had been a personality of a different sort, I might have followed it deeper, but it appeared to me to be ambiguous and evil. Not evil, maybe evil. What happened to me was, this was in Nepal years and years ago. Nepali shamanism is based in part on Datura, the taking of the seed capsules. An English friend of mine who had the room next to mine took it, and I took it in my room. And it was a situation where to get to the facilities, I had to walk through his room. And he and I were friends, but we had a very slight rivalry going for the attention of a woman. And I think this woman was not aware that either of us was interested in her, but we were both aware that the other one was aware. And midway through my trip, I decided I had to go to the bathroom, and so I stepped through into this guy's room, and they were in bed together having sex. And I guess I went outside, and then the next morning, after sleeping many hours, I encountered the guy, and I said, how was your trip? And he said, it was wonderful. And I said, yes, well, I saw. And he said, what did you see? And I said, well, I saw that you were with Julieta. And he said, I thought so too. But she wasn't there. And so, you know, what conclusion do we draw from this? That this stuff is, well, I'll tell you what took me off it finally was, about a week later, there seemed to be a rash of this Datura taking moving through the traveler community there in this little Nepali village where I live. And about a week later, I was buying tomatoes in the market, and I encountered a different person, but this English friend of mine. And he told me he'd been taking a lot of Datura, and I said, oh, well, that's interesting. I took it. I don't think I'll be taking it again. And as the conversation developed, I realized he thought we were in his apartment. And we were not. We were in the market. And, you know, this tells you it's time to dry out. Anyway, I use that as a springboard to different subjects. You were very patient. Next question.
I hope I can remember what my question
is. It's a test.
I agree that there's something sort of mysterious about where these psychedelic effects come from, and I refer again to the sort of classic psychedelic psilocybin LSD. But the fact that you generally need to take a substance or a drug, it's a material thing, does in some sense sort of go in a strange way to reinforcing a pretty basic scientific, almost mechanistic view of the universe. And I just wondered if you had thought about that or have any comments.
Well, let me try to convince you otherwise. I mean, I see what you're saying. You're saying that because this transformative, possibly spiritual experience is causally connected to the act of taking a matter of a certain type into your body, that it seems to argue for the materialist proposition that mind is an epiphenomenon of the functioning of brain and so forth. Am I restating it right?
Well, yeah, sort of, but I wouldn't necessarily go so far as to say that it forces you to conclude that the mind is an epiphenomenon of the brain, but that there is some sort of real validity to chemistry, mathematics, physics, and that you talked about the blockization at this moment, that those things are in some sense far more real than, say, channeling,
what did you say?
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
Well, yes, I mean, this relates to what I was saying about the balkanization of epistemology. It's really strange to me that science is in the act of flinging open the curtains on a staggering vision of what it is to be alive in this cosmos. I mean, we now can look back through the Hubble and other telescopes, you know, 13 billion years to within 600 million years of the primary explosion that presumptively created this universe. Meanwhile, we're tearing open the nature of the human genome, the nature of the heart of the atom. This is the great, great age for the expansion of the scientific vision, but the population is somehow incapable of staying up with what's going on, and so we have the greatest proliferation of occultism in all forms since the 16th century. It's almost as though there's a bifurcation of the culture. The scientific, the makers of new science are going deeper and deeper in the direction that the rest of the public not only cannot follow them into, but is actually headed the other way. And it's a condemnation of our educational system that people have not understood that science, for all its flaws, is the only tool for understanding the nature of reality that has any kind of track record whatsoever. The others just have a story to tell. You know, the Buddha story, the Jesus story, fine stories, but that's all they have is a rap. The amazing, you see, why is science different? Somebody could just say, well, but isn't it just a rap? Well, it is, but it plays by slightly different rules than these other explanatory systems. Science is the only explanatory system where you get points for proving you're wrong. You know? I mean, you form a hypothesis, you publish a paper, then you do further experiments. You discover your conclusions in paper A were completely wrong. You retract paper A and issue paper B, and your fellow scientists say, this guy does very good work. These are careful thinkers. You can bank on these people. They're not flaky. What religion operates like that? Can you imagine coming out of the ashram and saying, having the guru say to his students, well, we managed to reduce that hypothesis to rubble in morning meditation, didn't we? So, you know, and then let me return to answer that question based on my original misunderstanding of it. And I would say this, it is no reduction of the psychedelic experience to say that it is caused by drugs because they are material atomic systems and therefore we know all about them. Every electron is the yawning mouth of a wormhole that leads to quadrillions of higher dimensional universes that are completely beyond rational apprehension. Matter is not lacking in magic. Matter is magic. I mean, so when you hear these people like David Dennett and all these talk show materialists running around, these people haven't gotten the news that's coming out of quantum physics. I mean, you see, there's a problem, or let me describe to you the state of play here. The way science works is science respects fidelity of theory to experimental results. What really thrills a scientist is when you have a theory that makes a prediction down to 5 or 6 decimal points, and then you perform an experiment and it's spot on down to 5 or 6 decimal points. And then everybody involved in what's going on has extremely high confidence that they're on the right track. Well, now only one science is ever that good. Physics, macrophysics. Chemistry, it's good, but it's not that good. Ecology, biology, demography, these are pretty loose. They play with numbers, but it's a fig leaf. And by the time you get to sociology or something like that, I mean, these clowns have just snuck under the tent and should actually be shown the door and put back outside with the card readers. So for several hundred years, since, let's say, Galileo and serious physics, this is how science has been. It's been a pyramid of envy directed toward the paradigmatic science, which was physics, and which could produce this incredible congruence of theory and experimental data. Well, so then physics, of course, charges forward deeper into matter, asking deeper questions. Well, once you pass below the level of the electron, it's like smoking DMT or something. Absolute madness breaks out, where before you had these wonderful theories and they were feeding back this data. Now suddenly you have backward flowing time, you have particles which appear magically on one side of an energy barrier without apparently crossing through it. You have non-locality, which seems to imply that every particle that exists is somehow magically connected with every other particle. We now have quantum teleportation, we have black holes, we have singularities. And don't be fooled, folks. What is a singularity? It's just a place where you agree that the rules are canceled because you don't know what the hell else to do. And it's fine, you know. It used to be in physics that they had one singularity. It was called the Big Bang. And so you say, well, one singularity, essentially what science is saying is give us one free miracle, and then we can run it from there. But the theory of special relativity then introduced the concept of black holes, and of course, black holes are enormous gravitational masses, so massive that neither light nor information can leave them. And what do black holes have at the center of them? Well, a singularity. Well, how many black holes are there in the universe? 10 high 14? That's a lot of singularities if you're trying to produce a theory without singularities. I mean, essentially, that's an admission of total intellectual defeat. My God, if there are 10 high 14 singularities, you're not even doing science. You just might as well be, you know, channeling Atlantis or something. So, it troubles me because I think this stuff is rich. That physics is feeding back, and that ultimately a model of consciousness will come out of studying the deeper levels of the behavior of matter. But the conclusions are all going to support the non-scientific, non-rational factions. In other words, Bell non-locality is real. All matter in the universe is in contact with all other matter through some kind of higher space, based on their original connectivity. Quantum teleportation is a possibility. These violations, backward flowing time and violations of rational casuistry are all real. In other words, science, meaning physics at this point, prosecuted its agenda of deconstructing nature to the point where it let loose the elves of madness, paradox, contradiction, and peculiarity, and that can now never be put back. I mean, the dirty little secret is that at bedrock, the universe is more like a DMT flash than it is like an 18th century garden party, as we were previously assured by the practitioners of science. I think that's enough ranting on that subject. Yeah. If you want to ask a question, I guess what the consensus of the group is to go and stand, or I'll point to you. The reason we didn't originally say go and stand is because if you get a nut in the line, there's a certain fatedness to their eventually getting to the microphone, which if I am sensitive enough in the pointing out process, could never happen. So this is we're trusting that you're
saying. That's why I got up here early.
Yeah, good, okay. Thanks for being patient.
Thanks, Terrence. I had a technical question, but I think it's an interesting one and maybe important. Your name has become identified with the date 2012, mm-hmm. because you have said that at a certain moment in the year 2012, an event will take place of tremendous or even infinite novelty. And this is based on your work on what you call the time wave and novelty theory and so on, which seems to indicate that around that date, something extraordinary will happen. And you confirm this by saying that, interestingly and synchronistically, perhaps, I'm not sure whether that's what you appeal to, but you say that the Mayan calendar also points to precisely the same date. And number three, you say that at that time also an astronomical event will take place, namely the conjunction of the winter solstice with the galactic center, an event which only happens every 25,000 years, roughly 26,000 years. So the last time that happened, our ancestors were painting bison on the walls of caves. It's a long, long cycle, this precession of the equinoxes that brings the winter solstice around the circle of the zodiac every 26,000 years, and you say that this is going to happen again in the year 2012. What my question is concerned with is that third element, namely this precession of the equinoxes in the year 2012. As you know, the galactic center is not on the ecliptic, is not on the zodiac, but is a bit above it. And so the sun on the winter solstice will never be in conjunction with the galactic center. But an event that is linked with that, and I think far more precise and significant, is the fact that not in the year 2012, but right now, as we sit here, the winter solstice is moving into conjunction with the place where the galactic equator crosses the zodiac. This is happening now, 1998-1999. And I'm wondering why you look to this year 2012 and the imprecise conjunction with the galactic center rather than the precise and remarkable return of the winter solstice to the galactic equator where it was again 25,000 years ago when the cave paintings, when the first bursts of self-consciousness were occurring in our species. And I raise this not because I think or know that there's any truth to the meaning of this, but I do find it exquisitely beautiful that this is happening right now. I'm wondering what you think about that.
Well, thank you for framing and imparting your extremely intelligent question. I mean, you got it almost all right and all the details right. And for those of you who have no idea what that was all about, I'm not sure I can help you, but for those of you who do know what that was all about, here's my response. First of all, your statement that the galactic center is now transiting the solsticial node rather than in 2012, that's the only part of the thing you laid out that I would
that I would
disagree with, and here's why. When we say the galactic center, it turns out when you turn the lights on that concept that it's extremely slippery. The galaxy is not a basketball. It has a center of mass, which we can't determine from where we are because we're out on one limb edge of it. It has a center of luminosity. It has a volumetric center. I mean, how do you in fact even define what the galaxy is? Because at its outer edges, it feathers out into extragalactic space. Now, what we're arguing over here is a difference of 12 years. If we accept the premise that we're trying to locate a point in time where this conjunction of the galactic center and the heliacal rising of the solstitial sun occurs. Now, if you run out and buy a program to run on your PC, like Voyager, and you look at these solstitial sunrises over the next 14 or 15 years, it actually depends on the program you buy, what the contention is that is supported. This is a deep subject, very interesting, raises issues of bioastronomy, archaeoastronomy, galactic dynamics, complicated issues. A book has come out in the last 6 months called Maya Cosmogenesis 2012 by John Major Jenkins. He's a fine scholar. I wrote an introduction to the book, but he, over hundreds of pages, can educate you and bring you up to speed about these issues.